You're listening to the For I Will Be With You podcast. For I Will Be With You. Daily reflections on recovery from the Bible.
Welcome back to the For I Will Be With You podcast, covering the 21st week of the year from May 20th to May 26th, from Exodus 29:37 to Exodus 32:3. We're continuing with this series of instructions that God gives to Moses about the construction of the tabernacle, the Mishkan, the tabernacle that the Israelites were commanded to build in the wilderness when they were wandering in the wilderness after being freed from slavery in Egypt. The tabernacle was sort of a miniature version, so to speak, of the what became the temple in Jerusalem, a very similar layout and objects in it. It says in Exodus 29:37, "The altar shall be holy of holies. Whoever touches it shall become whatever touches it shall become sanctified." So the altar, one of the main purposes of the tabernacle was the performance of animal sacrifices. And the animal sacrifices were subject to very intricate laws that are detailed extensively in supplemental books to the Bible, like the Talmud and related books. Anyway, one of the issues that comes up with a sacrifice is that the sacrifice has to be offered perfectly. If something's done wrong, it's not considered a valid sacrifice. It's like it never was offered. And I know this may sound sort of strange from a modern perspective, but this was, you know, extremely important and really some of the most important ritual aspect of observance of God at this time, and is still very central. The ideas of it are very central to Jewish religious practice, and one of the things to understand when they say that a sacrifice is invalid is that the sacrifice doesn't perform the purpose that it was meant to serve. So, for example, if you committed a sin, you're supposed to bring a sacrifice to atone for the sin, and if the sacrifice was done wrong, then you didn't get atonement for your sin. So it was not a trivial thing. One of the ways that a sacrifice can be rendered invalid is by being brought at the wrong time. And so you could say, and I don't want to get into the specifics because it's too complicated, but, you know, like if you say, this sacrifice, I'm bringing the sacrifice on Tuesday, and then you bring it on Wednesday, that's just kind of a hypothetical example, it doesn't work. It's not a sacrifice. It's just an animal that got slaughtered and put on the altar. However, in a lot of cases, if the offering is done at the wrong time or done wrong in some way, the sages say that the sacrifice, once it comes into contact with the altar, the holiness of the altar, whatever touches it becomes holy, so it becomes legitimate. So kind of after the fact, it becomes legitimate. And I think for us, what does this mean to us? I know this is kind of an abstract idea, but I connect it to the way a lot of us feel out of place and of little use, you know, like a rejected offering. But like a rejected offering, we can be brought back to spiritual life by contact with holiness. Maybe you've experienced this. You have been felt like you were out of life. You were not in a life with a proper role to play in life, but somehow exposure to holiness brought you back into life, into conscious contact with God, into spiritual health. And this is like being in contact with the altar. And, you know, conversely, it can go in the other way. Once you've been in contact with the altar, you're holy. Then you need to act holy when you go out of the presence of the altar. You know, and I think that we see this in the setting of a meeting. When you talk to old timers and people of a lot of, you know, quality sobriety, they focus on setting a good example even when they're not in a meeting. And they focus on setting a good example to people who are new in the program and reaching out to them, and they're like the altar that we can touch and become holy. Exodus 30:13 said, God says to Moses, "This they shall give," meaning the Israelites shall give, "everyone who passes through the census, a half shekel of the sacred shekel." The shekel is 20 gerahs, half a shekel, as a portion to God. So what he's talking about here is the donation of a coin, a half shekel, which is a small amount of money. Nobody really knows what it's worth, but imagine for the sake of argument that it's like a quarter or something. It's like a small, it's a coin. So the way that this is, the instruction really was for Moses to do a census. Moses was ordered to count the Israelites. So the way they did this was, instead of counting people, they had everybody throw a coin in a box, and they counted up the coins. This was probably one level easier to do than counting people up by one at a time, but there's much more to it, of course, as there always is in the Bible. For example, we know that this coin, the half shekel, is worth another coin, 20 gerahs. It's like saying that a quarter is worth 25 cents. So why doesn't the Bible just say, have everybody donate 20 gerahs? They don't. The Bible doesn't. And this is, there's a concept in this that we can learn from, that which is, symbolically, it's like each of us is half complete spiritually. We are half fulfilled, like the half shekel. When we come together, we put our coins together, we become full. We complete each other. And this is, I think, an important truth in recovery, that none of us is really completely equipped to deal with recovery. When we come together, we become one. We unify our purpose, and we are able to achieve greater conscious contact, greater recovery, greater spiritual health than we can on our own. Another way to look at this, Exodus 30:13, a donation of the half shekel, is another comment that comes up is that everybody gave the same coin. So if you were rich, you gave a half shekel, and if you were poor, you gave a half shekel. So what do we learn from this? It says each of the Israelites had to share equally in achieving the national goals. And this is similar, I think, in AA. Everybody, you know, we contribute, we're self-supporting through our contributions, we contribute what we can, but there certainly isn't, everybody contributes, you know, more or less the same thing. Everybody throws, you know, a dollar in the basket or whatever it is. There's no, graduated income tax in AA where they're like, oh, well, you're rich, well, you better give $10. It's, you know, we each have an equal role to play. And it's just one of many rules. If you look at the rules of AA, the traditions, the way, the rules that of the organization, they are brilliantly set up, I think divinely inspired, to enable people to make an individual contribution, you know, on an equal basis, and that there's a lot of instilling of this idea of equality, that people have an equal voice and an equal right to participate and so forth. And then we're all equally elevated. We can potentially be equally elevated by our participation in the group. We contribute our half, and we become a much greater whole. Exodus 30:17. God says to God spoke to Moses, saying, "You shall make a copper laver and its base of copper for washing. Place it between the tent of meeting and the altar, and put water there. From it Aaron and his sons shall wash their hands together with their feet." So this requires a little bit of explanation. The laver, which is a word for a washing vessel, like a lavatory, a laver, it was made out of copper, and it was placed inside the tabernacle. And the tabernacle had actually a sort of tent within itself. So it's this tent of meeting, which is what they called this inner tent, and there was a courtyard outside, and the altar was outside the tent. So the laver was in between these two things. It was between the tent and the altar. And it's, and once again, if there's some, if you look online and stuff, you can see some really interesting depictions of what these vessels actually looked like and what, where they were placed. There's some very precise and accurate layouts of what the tabernacle looked like in terms of its size and layout. So, and Aaron, who was the priest, the high priest, and his sons, who were the priests, had to wash their hands and feet before they went into the tent of meeting to perform special spiritual rituals. And of course, we see this today. This is a very common thing. You walk into, you know, almost any church or synagogue, and you'll see some kind of special sink or wash basin for washing your hands. This is a, this carries through to this day, this idea that you have to wash yourself before you do holy things. And people wash before they eat and that kind of thing. I happen to personally love this verse a lot. It's meaningful to me, but I think that, and so I tend to talk about it maybe too much, but there's an idea in recovery that we need to cleanse ourselves before we go into contact with God. Because addiction is dirty. I mean, it's literally can be dirty. I mean, people talk about the kind of filth they were living in or whatever when they were acting out. But it's also, maybe more importantly, a spiritual dirt and toxin that has to be washed off, so to speak. And I think that this symbolic washing of the hands is reminiscent of how we can cleanse ourselves from the impurity of addiction. And what's interesting too in this laver is that it was really kind of like, I've seen pictures of what people think it looked like. It was sort of like it was like two urns kind of with little spigots, so you could actually wash your hand and foot at the same time. Kind of an interesting device. But there's something important there. It's not just making your feet and hands clean. It's about your hands and your feet, meaning wash your hands. Your hands represent what you're doing in your life, and your feet, which represent where you're going. Where are you going and what are you doing? I know a person whose mother used to always ask him that. Where are you going and what are you doing? And that was a good question, two good questions, because those things go together. You know, you can't say, oh, I'm going to a bar, but I'm not going to drink anything, right? If you're going somewhere bad, you're going to do something bad. You need to wash, or if you're doing something bad, it may lead you to go somewhere bad, and so forth. So the idea of the laver can be brought out for us to think, this is about keeping track, cleansing ourselves to help us avoid doing things that are bad for us and going places that are bad for us. Exodus 31 to 34 says, 31:1 to 31:4 says, God spoke to Moses saying, see, I have called by the name Bezalel, son of Uri, son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah. I have filled him with godly spirit, with wisdom, insight and knowledge, and with every craft to weave designs, to work with gold, silver, and copper, stone cutting for setting, and wood carving to perform every craft. So Bezalel, or Bezalel, is the craftsman, the artist, who is going to build the tabernacle. He's one man. He's going to do it all, basically. I mean, I guess other people will help him, but he's the main designer, architect, craftsman of the tabernacle. And the tabernacle was a pretty big project. And what's really amazing is that commentators say that Bezalel wasn't even a man. He was 13 years old. He was a 13-year-old boy. And somehow this 13-year-old boy who'd grown up in slavery and had never seen the materials like gold and silver and all this fancy cloth and stuff that they were going to build this tabernacle, he was going to do the whole thing. So here's a good question. How is this possible? The answer that's given is that God filled him with these abilities. And in fact, in Hebrew, the word Bezalel means in the shadow of God. Be in etzal el, in the shadow of El, God is Elohim in Hebrew. But it's all the word. And this is just as a kind of a maybe an interesting footnote. Many names of people in the Bible have meanings in the Hebrew language that are significant to to understanding the spiritual purpose of the person. Anyway, so God filled him with holiness and with this artistic spirit. And, you know, in general, I think we can learn from this that, you know, God can fill us with spirit. God can endow us with amazing talents if we seek contact with God. And we should remember that our talents and our abilities flow from God, that we are essentially vessels for God, or we channel God in our creativity. And I've certainly seen in recovery this incredibly impressive experience so many times that when someone becomes sober and gets a little bit of real good sobriety, that this sort of other person emerges from inside. And I've seen people, you know, go from just being, I mean, literally like living on the street, and all after a while, all of a sudden they're doing photography, art, writing, business. People sort of come to life in recovery. And it's like, where did all that come from? It's like, well, maybe it was there all the time, but God sort of brought it out of this person in recovery, all this ability, all this achievement. And of course, there are people who are tremendously successful once they hit recovery, and it's absolutely fascinating. So anyway, God can fill us in this way, maybe even with talents we didn't know we had. Another way to look at the story of Bezalel is that he was given wisdom from God. But one of the commentators says that wisdom also consists of knowledge we acquire from others. So maybe another interpretation of Bezalel was he was endowed with a talent. One of his talents was to listen to other people, and he learned from other people because there were other people amongst the group who knew how to cut stone and wood and silver and gold and weave cloth and that kind of thing. So his talent, one of his talents, was to learn how to be open to other people's learning. And I think that there's a lesson here for us, that if we can open ourselves up to listening to other people, that we can improve ourselves. We can learn at the very least how to stay sober. And we have to learn to listen to the message that we're being given and the direction we can get from other people. And it also may mean learning to listen to our own inner voice. This is another angle on this, is that we have the knowledge within us, but we have to open ourselves up to access it. And I'll just share a brief anecdote about myself to illustrate this concept, both for better or worse, which is that I make my living as a freelance writer, but I was not always a freelance writer. I was for many years an executive, a business executive, and it took me many years to realize that I was not a good executive. I had many, many reasons to ignore the reality that this wasn't my thing, and that I was much better at other things. It took a long time, but I finally, and I think recovery was part of this, just learning to listen to myself. There's something I was trying to tell myself, but I couldn't hear. I'm a lot happier now that I listen to myself. Exodus 32:3 starts the description of one of the most terrible and notorious incidents in the entire Bible, which is the building of the golden calf. It says, "The entire people removed the gold rings that were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. He took it from their hands and bound it up with a cloth and fashioned it into a molten calf. They said, 'This is your God, O Israel, which brought you up from the land of Egypt.'" This is a notorious chapter and a shameful chapter in the Bible. And It is. It's really, it's shocking, but it, I think for people who are in addiction, it's not shocking. You know, but here we have the Israelites just about a few weeks after the revelation of the Ten Commandments. You know, the most spectacular whole incident of holiness in history, really. Their reaction is to build an idol, something that's specifically forbidden by God, and something they've specifically agreed not to do. But here they are. So what happened? What is going on? And why would the people do such a thing? I think anybody who's struggled with addiction is going to understand what's going on much more clearly, maybe, than someone else. Recovery, you know, like freedom from slavery, is a fragile state of mind. The old habits, the enslavement, and the urge to be in a familiar but maybe terrible condition is very powerful. There's a desire to go back to what you know and what somehow felt good at the time, or maybe had moments where it felt good. It's an edgy time, new sobriety. People are raw, they're edgy, they don't feel well. Physically, they are uncomfortable, they're anxious. The slightest problem can make you want to run for safety, and safety might look like a needle or a bottle. So what happened was that there was a misunderstanding. The people, Moses went up on Mount Sinai by himself after the Ten Commandments were given, and he went up to receive more wisdom from God, and he was up there for a period of time, for 40 days. But the people became confused. They thought he was supposed to come down on a certain day, and he didn't come down, and they had the wrong day. They started counting at night instead of daytime or something. They were wrong or off by a day. They didn't see him, and they became frightened. They thought that he had abandoned them or that he had died. And in their fear, they built this idol. Now that is really, to me, a symbolic of an addictive relapse. Someone is finally on their way out of addiction. They're in recovery. They find someone to help them, and then there's a setback, and they become scared, and they go running back to the bad way of life, to this personal idolatry, this golden calf, which they're going to worship instead of a real higher power. And it's something that we may have to struggle with. I think that the incident in the Bible is one of the reasons it's in the Bible is to help us think about moments like that. And what can we do to get through them, and what we can do to avoid them.
You've been listening to the For I Will Be With You podcast. Daily reflections on recovery from the Bible. www.foriwillbewithyou.com